thank you very much for the beautiful special music. Such a treat to have special music every Sabbath, or most every Sabbath here, isn't it? Well, hello to all those listening in on the webcast, and certainly hello to all those here live and in person. Have a few returning with us. I haven't been here in a while. It's nice to see Mrs. Moots here today. I see an old fellow on the right that I vaguely recognize. It's would be my dad. He's been out for a few weeks, but it's great to have him back here as well. So welcome to all. As many of you know, this coming week is the start of Camp Buckeye. We'll be heading up there. I'm looking very much forward to that. I'm excited. This year I get to work with the younger kids, the boys in the B2 dorm. It's very exciting. I don't know who's more excited, them or me. I do know who's going to be more tired at the end of the week, though. I'm looking very much forward to it. What did you hear about the little boy came rushing into church late one day? Just got there just in the nick of time. As he got there, a woman standing there in the back of the church hall saw him, recognized him, knew that he was normally there on time, usually a little bit early. And she thought it was a little bit unusual that he was running a little bit late. She said, "Johnny, is everything all right?" Johnny kind of had a sheepish look on his face. He said, "Well, I'm running a little bit late today because I was going to go fishing instead of coming to church. But my dad told me I had to come to church." And the lady thought, "Oh, well, you know, that's good. I'm certainly very, very glad that you came to church. Did your dad explain to you why it is you needed to come to church?" And he said, "Oh, yes, he explained it. He made it very clear. He explained that there wasn't enough bait for us to both go fishing, so I was going to have to come to church." Dad kind of missed the point of the command there, didn't he, maybe? Well, that's not an uncommon problem, is it, for people to miss the point of the commandments? You know, most biblical scholars will tell you that in the first five books of the Bible alone, there are 613 individual recognized commandments. Now, many of these we might think of as being redundant. For example, if you look in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 13, there's a specific command that tells us if we are strangers in a strange land, or if we have sojourners coming into our land, we are not to teach them to worship idols. Well, you would think that'd be rather obvious. If we're not to worship idols, we shouldn't be teaching people to worship idols. But that's one of the individual 613 of the Pentateuch most recognized. Now, other commands might be obvious to us, maybe not quite so obvious to the world around us. We know in Leviticus 23, we're told that we are to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and we're to keep that in temporary dwellings. So that's something you and I grew up with and know very well, but maybe something that's not quite as obvious to everyone else. Others, though, are still yet more obscure. I was looking through and I was amazed at all these individual commands, things that I'd read over before and never really thought much of. For example, in the book of Numbers, there's a specific command that said that if a man felt like his wife may have behaved unfaithfully towards him, but he wasn't sure, he was supposed to bring a meal offering before the priest. And that's not the only command. There was a specific subset in that command, a separate one of those 613, that said that meal offering could not contain frankincense. Now, that might seem oddly specific, and I'm sure there was a reason, but I have to admit, that's one that I wasn't very familiar with. So it got me to thinking, what is the most difficult command to keep? You know, I suppose that can be very subjective. Prison systems are filled with people who love their mother and father, but perhaps in a moment of rage, or maybe in drunkenness, they took a life, they committed a murder. Likewise, many marriages are broken up every year by adultery. And people who commit adultery might have no trouble not committing a murder. So I suppose it could be a little bit subjective. So the question of what the most difficult command to keep is a tricky one. But it's one I'd like to explore with you today. What is the most difficult command to keep? Knowing that there were at least 613 commands there in the first five books of the Bible, you can kind of get a feeling for where the young man was coming from when he came to Christ in Matthew chapter 22. Let's go ahead and turn there. Matthew 22, we'll start in verse 34. Matthew 22, verse 34. It says, "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, 'Teacher, which is the great command, or which is the great commandment in the law?'" So Christ had already silenced the Sadducees. Now the Pharisees were coming to him. One of them comes to him, testing him. Now, we kind of presume that this was a trick question, that he was trying to trip up Christ. I suppose it's possible that maybe this was a legitimate question that the young man had. Either way, though, we know the answer that Christ gave was a legitimate answer. The answer comes in verse 37. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." These would not have been new words for the scribe to have heard. Christ was quoting directly from the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 6 and verse 5. We won't turn there, but you can jot that down in your notes. Look it up later on. Over 1,000 years ago, Moses heard these words and proclaimed them to Israel. Likewise, going on here in verse 39, so the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Again, this was not new news. You can find this in Leviticus 19 and verse 18. In verse 40, Christ says, "On these two commandments hang all of the law and the prophets." Christ said, this is it. This is the heart and core of all commands. I saw something the other day from Reader's Digest. And it kind of reimagined the Ten Commandments. It said, what if God had texted Moses the Ten Commandments? And I gave three or four here. I'll share some of them with you. First one, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," came across as a text that says, "No gods before me." Seriously. The third one, "Not to take the Lord's name in vain." Very simply put, no OMGs. How often do you hear that phrase? It drives me up a wall. There was a house for sale down the road from us last year, and in big orange and pink and green letters they had out there on the side of the road, you know, "Great house, OMG. And I wanted to flatten that sign with my pickup truck, but I didn't do it. Imagine the commandment to honor your mom and dad being texted as, "Yo, M and D are cool." M and D being shorthand for mom and dad. Now, these, of course, don't convey the weight of the commands. That's kind of a funny way to put them in the modern vernacular. But Christ didn't put them in the modern vernacular, did he? No, he actually did the opposite. He quoted from the Old Testament. But he did indeed offer them as a summary of the law and the prophets. However, he didn't say anything about them being difficult at that point, did he? He did expound on the difficulty, though, over in Matthew 5. And let's go there. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 5, just a few pages back. Matthew 5, and we'll start in verse 21. Matthew 5, verse 21. It says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." You could say that Jesus Christ showed that commandment keeping is more difficult than just keeping the letter of the law, isn't it? It matters what's in our heart. You know, the guy who cuts you off in traffic? It's not enough that we just don't pull the car over and kill him. We have to change our heart and our mind and how we react to such things. Going on down, verse 27. It says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." The physical act of adultery is a sin. There's no question about it. But whether we sit there, if you look and lust at another woman, through fantasy, through pornography, whatever it might be, to lust is that same sin. Christ showed through these two examples that keeping the commands is much more difficult than just keeping the letter of the law. Jesus Christ taught that sin starts in the mind, and it must be addressed there. Paul shared a similar thought, 2 Corinthians. I'm going to begin turning to 2 Corinthians, verse 10, or chapter 10, rather. Second Corinthians 10, and we'll pick it up here in verse 3. It says, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh." Paul's saying the struggle is real, y'all. This is hard. Verse 4 says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity through the obedience of the law." Just as Christ said and taught, Paul points out that this struggle, the real difficult struggle, occurs in our minds. It's not just the physical things that we struggle with, is it? It's the thoughts, it's the trouble in between our ears sometimes. And isn't that what the scribes and Pharisees tried to do? Didn't they try to find the loopholes and go around, find a way around the physical keeping of the law at times? Or rather, find a way around the intent of the law just to keep the physical parts? If we read the rest of this chapter, you see that Paul was defending his authority a bit and the boldness with which he spoke. But he points out something very important to us. I'd like to read verse 4 again, this time from the New Living Translation. It says, "We use God's mighty weapons, not worldly weapons, to knock down the strongholds of human reasoning and to destroy false arguments. We destroy every proud obstacle that keeps people from knowing God. We capture their rebellious thoughts and teach them to obey Christ." It's not just the scribes and the Pharisees, is it, that argued with the law, with Christ, to try to find loopholes? They're not the only ones to put up proud obstacles. They're not the only ones who try to reason out, "Well, maybe this is why I don't have to obey the law. Maybe I don't have to honor my mom and dad because, you know, mom always liked my brother best." Not your mom. But we try to reason out and justify ourselves, justify why we do things or why we feel different ways. And sometimes we try to justify what it is and why it is we don't do things. And that leads us to the commandment that I think is sometimes the most difficult one to keep. Let's turn ahead to the book of James. James chapter 4. James 4, verse 13. We'll pick it up here. James 4 and verse 13. It says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." James is reminding us not to trust in our education, our business acumen, our investments, anything of the sort, any degree, any training, any title we might have. To do so is arrogance. Rather, we must do as Christ did and ask if it's in God's will. And then notice what he says here in verse 17. And this is the one I really want to focus on today. James 4:17. It says, "Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is a sin." talking about the sin of omission versus commission, as you've probably heard it put before. If you read through the rest of James 4, you'll see that there's a lot of focus on pride, presumptuousness, the need for humility. Verse 17 then concludes at the end of 16 verses of talking about pride and the need for humility. Verse 17 concludes with a therefore statement. In other words, because of all of this, to him who knows to do good and does it not, to him it is a sin. I think it's profound, this little bit of wisdom. What does that mean? The New Century Version translates verse 17 this way. It says, anyone who knows the right thing to do but does not do it is sinning. Now, maybe this isn't the most difficult command to keep. But if not, perhaps it's one that I think we're in danger of overlooking sometimes if we're not careful. Can we conclude then that pride is an obstacle of doing good? I think we can. I think it's no coincidence that there are 16 verses here dealing with that. In a conclusion, that therefore statement tells us if we know to do good and we don't do it, then we are sinning. Sometimes we come up with justifications. Well, I don't think I need to do anything because I. There's a lot of I's in that statement, isn't there? You know who's got two thumbs and guilty of doing that? This guy. We've all done it at times, haven't we? And it's those thoughts of pride. Those are the things that we must bring into captivity so that when we know to do good, we can remove those obstacles and we can indeed do good. The same principle that Jesus taught about sin starting in our mind and needing to be addressed here applies here, needing to be addressed there in our mind, applies here as well. I think it's interesting looking through James. It's probably not hard to figure out where he got this inspiration. We know that James was the younger half-brother of Jesus Christ. Since their physical father, Joseph, as far as we can tell, died at a rather early age, it's natural that their physical older brother, of course our spiritual older brother, Jesus Christ, was who they looked to for guidance. Now we know that the family scoffed at him during his ministry, but we also know, evidenced here by the book of James, that apparently at some point in time, later on, James came around to understand that even if he didn't believe the things that Christ said at the time, he knew what he saw. He knew about the example that he saw Jesus Christ live. I think that went on to influence him here in what he wrote. James is simply looking at this core concept of sin starting in our mind and having to be addressed there in a slightly different way. Knowing to do something, yet choosing not to do it, I think is the epitome of sin starting and ending in our minds. How many of you have read George Orwell's 1984? Remember that one? Okay, if you're literature fans. All right. I think it's the ultimate thought crime. To know to do something, yet not to do it. That's something in our mind. Nobody can tell what's going on up there. I can't tell what's going on up there sometimes. So how do we then go about keeping this, perhaps most difficult command to keep? How do we go about taking the time to do good, to know what needs to be done? Well, as Christ said, it starts in the mind, must be addressed there. Let's go back a few verses in James 4 and read verse 7. The title on the subsection here in my Bible is called Humility Cures Worldliness. It says, therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament, mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. I'd like to read that again from the New Century Version. says, give yourselves completely to God. Stand against the devil, and the devil will run from you. Come near to God, and God will come near to you. You sinners, clean sin out of your lives. You who are trying to follow God and the world at the same time, make your thinking pure. Be sad, cry, and weep. Change your laughter into crying and your joy into sadness. Humble yourself in the Lord's presence, and He will honor you. We can't be double-minded. We can't be proud and humble at the same time. And my father-in-law often jokes, he says, you can't be humble and proud of it. We've got to lament the sins that we have in our lives. We have to have an earnest desire to purge this pride from ourselves. We've got to ask God to clean our heart, as David did in Psalm 51. And notice what it says in verse 10. This is a promise. Humble yourself in the Lord's presence, and He will honor you. This is an if-then sort of a statement, if you've ever done any programming. If we humble, if we seek God, ask to have a humble heart so that we can serve Him, He is going to honor that. Those are the sort of petitions and prayers that God desires to hear and to honor. Helps us to overcome that source of our sin. Once we do that, and of course, that's not a one-time thing, that's an ongoing process, asking for humility. What's next? Well, I think we could apply James 4:17 in a few different ways. Certainly the example used here was in a presumptuous business deal. You might also be able to apply it. Someone knows to keep the Sabbath, but chooses not to for whatever excuse they might have. But I'd like to focus in a slightly different way, and I really appreciated Mr. Van Osdale's message this morning, and that is how it applies to doing good for others. In my notes, I started to write that James 4:17 tells us we need to take the opportunity to do good. And I thought, you know what? There's a problem with that. And that is heresy. Mr. Myers doesn't put a lot of restrictions on us as speakers, but that's one of them. I looked at 21 different scriptures, or rather 21 different translations of this scripture. Not one says if there's an opportunity to do good, do good. No. It says, and this is the New Living Translation, says, remember, it is a sin to know what you ought to do and then not to do it. Nowhere does it say anything about time and chance, or if you get around to it. Did you ever have one of those wooden nickel type of things that maybe you got at the county fair and it has the letters T-U-I-T on it? So all those times you said, well, when I get around to it, I'll do it. And they would hand you that and say, well, here's a round to it. So I am around to it. The command is that when we know to do good, we are to do it. This is emphasized in the book of 1 John, chapter 3. Turn over a few pages there. 1 John 3 and verse 10. 1 John 3, verse 10. It says, in this the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. We can see who God's children are and who the children of the devil are by their actions. We show them by how we work. It becomes intuitively obvious to the casual observer. How many have ever heard that phrase before? Intuitively obvious to the casual observer. Okay, so that's a phrase that's used a lot in legal stuff, particularly in patents and inventions. And what that means, it's intuitively obvious. You don't have to have, you know, a degree in chemical engineering if it's a patent for a chemical process. It becomes obvious, like the fact that the sun is shining, or the fact that a baby has a dirty diaper. As Bob Dylan said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. It's very obvious. We don't do good in order to be noticed, do we? But it will be obvious whose children we are when we take time to see good and to do it. Christ said in Matthew 7, by our fruits that you would know us. Going on in verse 11. It says, for this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. It's the same as that second summary commandment that Jesus Christ gave. John even points out, it's the same as the beginning. Nothing new here. Leviticus 19:18, just as Christ repeated. Skipping on down a bit, verse 16. It says, by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for brethren. Christ laid down his life for us. Did he do it just because the opportunity came up? He had nothing to do on a Wednesday afternoon except go be crucified? No. He was motivated by love to do good for each and every one of us and for each and every being that has ever or will ever live. Verse 17. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? That's a rhetorical question here. But it's saying, if you have the ability to do good and we're not doing it, can the love of God be in you? No. No, it can't. Finally, in verse 18, we get to where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. Verse 18 says, my little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. This is a mantra that is repeated throughout the Bible. You can see it in Romans 2:13. In fact, James talked about it here. We'll just turn back a couple pages to James 1 and verse 22. This mantra is repeated throughout the Bible. We must do things. We can't just think pure thoughts. Think good things, and everything will be fine. We must put our money where our mouth is, sometimes literally. James 1:22 says, but be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. No doubt, this is the example that James saw firsthand. Through his older brother, Jesus Christ. Through our elder brother, Jesus Christ. We've got to take action. We've got to do good when we know that there is good to be done. Let's begin to wrap up here. Let me ask you this. You ever get that little voice in the back of your head? To me, that little voice sounds a lot like Tom Selleck. I grew up watching Magnum P.I., and if you remember the first few years of the early episodes, he would be working on a case and, you know, cruising through the hills of Hawaii in his Ferrari, and the answer seemed so obvious to what the case, you know, whodunit. But then he'd say, I got this little voice in the back of my head. So something's not quite right. That little voice is the Holy Spirit guiding us, saying, you know, I know if so-and-so is having some trouble, maybe with their computer, or their car, or their house. Well, maybe I could stop by on the way home. Well, no, I don't want to be a bother. I don't want to intrude. They probably got taken care of anyway. We wind up talking ourselves out of it. No, I've done that too many times, only to find out later, wow, you know, on that random Tuesday, that person really could have used that help. God was trying to guide me. Go help them. I knew to try to do good, and I didn't do it. And that's hurtful. And that's hurtful, and I think that's why this can be the hardest command to keep. Because we begin to doubt. The source we saw clearly is our pride. Well, I don't really need to do this. Maybe we think, oh, that person, you know, they got it covered. No. Don't talk ourselves out of doing good. Suppose you should be courteous, of course. Don't just drop in on somebody unless, you know, you have a very close relationship and they're fine with that. Call them. But don't wait for the opportunity to just fall in your lap to do good. Take that first step. Send that email. Send that text. Make a phone call. Look for an opportunity to do good. And it doesn't have to be anything big. It doesn't have to be something tangible, like a car or a house. Take the opportunity to maybe call someone who's been going through a tough emotional time, maybe someone who's shut in. Take 5 or 10 minutes from your day. They will love to hear from you. Oftentimes we talk ourselves out of it saying, well, I hardly know that person. Well, hey, guess what? You know what's a good way to get to know them? Pick up your phone. Give them a call. Encourage them. And I will bet you will find out you are far more encouraged than what you ever dreamed you could be. Brethren, when we hear that little voice telling us to do good, that is the Holy Spirit there guiding us. John 16 shows us that in verse 13. Let's not ignore it. Let's heed that voice to do good. Let's not let things like pride become obstacles for us, or wait around for an opportunity to do good, or find excuses not to take the time to do good. Let's ask God to help remove our pride. Help us to be humble so that we can serve the way that He wants us to. And there's no exceptions, not for me, for no one. And let's do the good that we know it is we should do, just as Jesus Christ did for us. And I think we will come to see very clearly that the hardest command is not so hard after all.